The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of stewardship.
Let's take a look at Matthew chapter 25 and pick up on a theme of stewardship. I want to speak about another leadership principle, and the one that I want to focus in on is the biblical principle of stewardship, a huge issue in Scripture, really, from Genesis to Revelation, an enormous issue. Because we are seen as people who have been given a measure of time on the planet. And God alone knows the amount of time He's allotted to us. The fact is that you and I don't get to determine how long we labor in the vineyard. Some people labor for a year or more, some for 20, 30 years, some for the 70 years or more. The fact is, it's not the issue of how long you labor in the vineyard, but it's what you do with your time. At the end of the day, it's going to be the amount of time, but more than the amount of time, how you've invested that time, whether you've squandered it or whether you've invested it. And this stewardship parable here in the parable of the talents in Matthew 25 illustrates this contrast between two people who squandered and two who invested, and two who squandered. You know the story fairly well. I won't read the whole text, but basically he gave five talents to one, another he gave two talents to another, one talent. The interesting phrase is each according to his ability, so that the imagery you have here is it was relative to their ability. I want you to observe something that's significant in this parable. We're going to see that reward in the kingdom of heaven is based on faithfulness to opportunity, not to how much time, talent, or treasure you've been given. So it's a divine equalizer. So that those who've been given much by way of resources, whether it is time or talent or treasure, do not necessarily have an advantage of those who have less. The issue is what we do with what we've been given. As you will go further in the parable, you discover that after a long time, verse 19, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the five talents brought the other five. Master, he said, you entrusted me with five talents. See, I've gained five more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's joy or happiness. The man with the two talents also came. Master, you entrusted me with two talents. See, I have gained two more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. May I observe that the response was identical in both cases. The response was really, because you were faithful in investing what you received, therefore the best word you can hear is, come enter into the joy of your master, which is the word we all want to hear. I believe that all of us would like to live a life in such a way that at the end we hear Jesus tell us, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your master. I think those are the best words a human being can ever hear. Just as the worst words a human being can ever hear are, depart from me, for I never knew you. So you have those radically, the interesting thing is the best and worst words all relate to your relationship with Jesus, either into his joy or into separation from him, because he never knew us. And so this image here. Now in the third case, the fellow squandered it and just buried it and then just gave it back to him. And he was severely rebuked and punished for that, because the result was that he had not invested the money, he had only buried it. My thinking in this text is that, again, with stewardship, there are always two parties involved. With stewardship, you've got the idea of the master who hands out resources and one day will ask for an account of how those resources were used. And then secondly, of course, the steward who's entrusted with resources and must eventually answer to how they were invested. Remember, again, with stewardship, the fundamental principle in stewardship is that a steward owns nothing, but only manages the possessions of another. It's a huge, important idea. That you and I own nothing in this world, but we only manage the possessions that were entrusted to us for a few decades. And the issue of accounting will always be, how did we handle them? Faithfulness. So this becomes a key theme in Scripture, going from Genesis to Revelation. Now let me focus first on stewardship and who God is, and invite you to turn to Psalm 104, one of my favorite psalms, because it's a beautiful portrait of a God who is rich in his overflow of diversity, of beauty and love, that he himself is the fountain of love that has always existed within the triune Godhead. That love that existed there is such that God, remember, I must stress, when he created the world and created us in it, to know him, was not lonely or bored. You need to understand this. God was not lonely, nor was he bored. That he had perfect communal relationship and a perfect community of being, the lover and the beloved, and the love that flowed between them, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So God was not needing some kind of an I vow. He already had that. It's very important. And again, may I stress the uniqueness of this, because you'll find it nowhere else. The I thou within the Godhead is unique only to biblical Christianity. You'll find it nowhere else. Yet, as I stressed before, it requires more than one person for there to be love. So if God is truly to be a lover, there must be more than one person within his fellowship. The triunity of God is a deep and abiding mystery. And that's the ultimate foundation for relationships, for people. Created in his image, we're designed for an I-thou relationship, not an I-I relationship or an I-it relationship. So the ultimate joy in life, then, is to really reflect the image of God within us as relational beings who discover that the true joys of life are always going to be the nourishment of an I-thou relationship, that they're a subject-object and the love that flows between them, that relationships always are reflective of the image of God within us because he himself is a relational being. And more than just a relational being, he is an incredibly creative being. So in Psalm 104, it's a portrait of the beauty and the glory of God and how his whole created order is filled with expressions of wonder and adoration because all things find their origin in him and all things are nourished by him. And we see, for example, in Psalm 113 where it says, "Who is like the Lord our God, the one who sits enthroned on high, who stoops down to look in the heavens and the earth?" But I go to Psalm 104 and I see how the psalmist says, "Praise or bless the Lord, O my soul, O my God, you are very great. You're clothed with splendor and majesty. He wraps himself in light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent and lays the beams of his upper chambers on their waters." Not a bad image, right, by the way, since we recently realized that the heavens are indeed continuing to be stretched out. As we know, it turns out that the actual expansion of the universe is accelerating, and consequently it was necessary to postulate this dark energy to account for it. No one knows what it is. But the fact is it continues to be stretched out before him for a period of time. He lays the beam of his upper chambers on their water, makes the clouds his chariot, and rides in the wings of the winds. Imagery here of the heavens, and then on the earth, how the earth, verse 5, has been set on its foundations. And then he describes how the seas, the waters, float over the mountains and ultimately the boundary that they cannot cross. After he is an image, by the way, of the flood. The imagery in Scripture, by the way, is that all the land was in one place and all the water in another. And that eventually it all broke up. Even geologists talk about that. They call it Gondwana land. You set a boundary that they cannot cross. He makes springs pour water into the ravines. So he gives a portrait of nature. Looks at the birds of the air in verse 12 and how he waters the mountains from his upper chambers, how he makes the grass grow in verse 14, wine that gladdens the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, bread that sustains his heart. The imagery here that God has created a very fertile and though a fallen world, still the fecundity of this world is so extraordinary, not only in its provision for us, but also in the rich diversity of plants and animals, both large and small. And the more you reflect on that, the more stunned you become. You realize, of course, don't you, that less than 10%, probably a very tiny percent, of all the species that ever were are now alive. The vast majority of all the species that walked on the earth are gone and will never be reproduced. Furthermore, you know that there are no new species being created. You do understand this, don't you? Because it requires new genes to be formed and there aren't any new genes being created. It's an interesting thought. We're actually seeing devolution, not evolution. But that's another story and I'm not going to digress. In any case, we see here the moon marks off the seasons, verse 19, you bring darkness and all the beasts of the forest prowl. The lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. The sun rises and they steal away and return and lie down in their dens. This is a wonderful image of the nocturnal beasts and then who man. Then man goes out to his work, to his labor until evening. How many of your works, O Lord, in wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. And then he muses over the sea, the ships that go to and fro, the beings that are in the great deeps. And then he says, verse 29, when you hide your face, they're terrified. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the earth. because their life is always as a result. All biological life comes from the hand of God, and he chooses to withdraw that, and then they depart. When you send your spirit, they're created, and you renew the face of the earth. And so this reflection, this meditation, is one that tells us about the richness of the abundant diversity and of creatures, a source of awe and amazement. And again, I might recommend that you, for an exercise sometime, just to reflect on the created order, because we're so separated, I fear, from the created order in many ways because of our artificial environments, that we rarely, like David, reflect upon the natural wonders of the world. You need to generally go off on a retreat to do that, and even then we're too busy to do it. But I would suggest that you just, for example, take an insect, the next one you find, instead of stamping the thing out, I might recommend you do, take that thing and look at it and meditate on that and study it and look at the actual incredible economy, the engineering of this thing, and the marvelous workmanship that's found in there, and to realize once again that you have something that no human being could have even dreamed up. And the idea here that you have something exquisite with its reproductive organs and its circulatory system, its neurological system, its ability to fly if it's a flying insect, its joints, and all the little features that are there, this microengineering, is exquisite beyond our imagination. And if you went further down inside it, you'd discover that the systems themselves, and within those systems, the various cells, would any cell from that insect would be more complex in its systems of transfer and creation and waste transfer and all kinds of other things, more complex than the city of Atlanta, with all the buildings and the plumbing and the electricity and all that, more complex one of those, any one cell would do. It's no accident. It's rich in its information and complexity. The more we learn, the more stunned we become by this reality. If you want to know, though, the most rich thing of all, it's the human brain, the most complex thing in all the created order. And may I tell you, you and I aren't smart enough to understand how our brain works, which is an interesting thought. We aren't clever enough to know how the brain functions. But that's another story again. My point here is that anything you meditate on the created order points beyond itself to spiritual truth and reveals the richness of God. Now, in light of this, Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 8:6, for us there is but one God the Father, from whom are all things, from whom all things came and for whom we live. One God the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live. And then he goes on to say, there is but one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live. So that it is through the Father and the Son that all things came from and through and for. And so we discover that you and I are part of that created order. It says in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19 and 20, you're not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God in your body. You see, God owns you doubly. Jesus owns you by virtue of having created you, and secondly, by virtue of having redeemed you. So you're doubly owned and not your own. Therefore, you have to have a mindset of stewardship. I'd like to turn also to Genesis, to go back to the original imagery of stewardship, with the dignity and responsibility that we've been entrusted as stewards of the resources and creatures of this planet. So when you and I, Genesis chapter 1, verses 18 to 30, when we shape and refine and creatively utilize the minerals and plants and animals that God's placed at our disposal, we're going to be accountable for the results. And in the image of stewardship and that mandate, we see that in this creation mandate, Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. We've done that rather well. That's one command we've done rather well as human beings. Rule thee over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves in the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They'll be yours for food. They remember they were not allowed to eat animals until after the flood. Only after that time in Genesis 9 was that mandate changed. They were vegetarians. To all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and after the creatures that move in the ground, everything that has the breath of life, he says, and I give every green plant for food, and it was so. So this idea here is that you have a picture of God's creative mandate to fill the earth and subdue it, which does not mean to exploit it and have dominion over it in the sense of using it for selfish purposes. We've done a great, rather good job of that as well. You could take, for example, non-renewable resources. I would use the rainforests as an example of that. We're messing with that, destroying them ultimately, and may I tell you, that's going to have a huge impact on the geoecology because of the delicate balance and homeostasis of the Earth's systems. To lose that much oxygen and so forth will have an impact. These are exquisite ecosystems that are systematically being destroyed as a consequence, I think, of human greed and presumption. We often suppose somehow these supplies are inexhaustible. But actually, the scriptures caution us to say, you will be given an account. Actually, the stewardship mandate had to do with fecundity, with fruitfulness. Let it be fruitful and bear. So that as people who have authority over this dominion, or this order, we are also called to be accountable for how we use it, and ultimately to be people who bring it and make it more fertile, not to destroy it. Now, I'm not going to go on to an ecological message. I think you might have been afraid I was going to move into some green stuff here, but instead I'm going to focus in instead on the fact that Psalm 24:1 reminds us that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. What do we own, you and I? The answer is not anything, not a lot, nothing. You and I don't own an acre. We own nothing. That's all on loan. And promise you, when you pass on, someone else will own it. And then it'll be taken from them, and so it goes. Speaking of stewardship, you recall I told you last week that I had the opportunity to go down to Florida and see a friend, a beloved brother of mine that I've known for 30 years. When I got back from Charlotte and Raleigh, I found out that he had passed away last Thursday. And so I do not regret that I went down there and saw him. It was just in time. Because he died very unexpectedly, very suddenly. They thought he'd have a few months. Never presume on that. So I do not regret that. I had clear closure. Remember my last words with him, the last words of affirmation, gave him some scriptures to reflect upon, expressed my love and gratitude for him. I have no regrets when I heard that. All was complete. And I know where he is. And so there's the assurance that this man now is receiving and has heard the well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master. That's the word you want to hear, and you want to realize, you want to live for that, with that in mind. Again, God reminds us in Psalm 50, verse 10, that every animal of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. You do not own them, I own it all. Thus, the steward manages the possessions of another, and I'm suggesting that stewardship not only involves the understanding of God's ownership of all, but also, again, as I said, an understanding of accountability and faithfulness. So that fidelity to your use. Now, 1 Corinthians 4:2 tells us, it's required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. So as a steward, you must be a faithful one. And may I tell you, it's rather humbling to realize that that nothing we are or possess is our own. We may theoretically say that, but how much do we really grasp this? How conscious of you are? Are you conscious of the ownership that God has of all things that you call your own? This would include your abilities. Sometimes people will acknowledge that God owns all their possessions and so forth, but they'll still be proud of their abilities, as if they were so clever to be around before the earth was created, clever enough to go to some primordial cafeteria to choose the best bits, and they were clever to choose those. No, you weren't around then. God gave you everything, so all, even that. What do you bring to the table that's not already been given to you? Therefore, why do you act as if it wasn't given to you? What do we have to prove? What do we have to boast about? The point is, nothing. It's all gift, and it's all accountability. So it's a question, then, of what you do with what you've been given. So I would invite you to develop a growing stewardship mentality, which is an awareness that you will one day give an account of how you have used the trusts in which you've been granted. That is a stewardship mindset. It's the understanding that this day has been given to me as gift, and He will hold me accountable for how I invest it. I have a choice today. I can either squander the opportunities that have been given to me and the resources today, this day, not the whole life, just today, or I can invest them. And if I invest them by leveraging the temporal resources into eternal people, into eternal beings, people, now I've done well. So the way in which I serve people at work and in my neighborhood, in my family, in my people I work with and play with and know, our relatives, the way I serve them becomes a question of stewardship. My next passage is Luke chapter 16, a notoriously tough parable about the issue of maximum possible return. Luke 16 is that notorious parable of the shrewd manager. I recently heard a sermon on it, and the guy totally missed the point of the parable. It was interesting. He must have spent some time working on it, but he totally missed the point. And it was just, you know, what happened, he was trying to preach in this thing, and I saw the ball rolled around on the floor, and nobody picked it up. You know, it was kind of embarrassing, the whole thing. He just missed this whole point. Came up with some idea from where, I don't know. Let me read this text to you, because it is a notoriously difficult one, at least give you my shot. Maybe I shouldn't be so arrogant. Maybe I'm going to miss the point of the parable. I'll let you be the judges of that, because before I get too cocky. Luke 16, verse 1. By the way, in context, he's just told three parables about that which is lost being found. So the idea here is all still in the context of the tax collectors and sinners. We're all gathering around to hear him. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So that, and then he answers that with three parables: the parable of the lost coin, the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And describes how God's more concerned, and that there's a greater joy in heaven than when one person who's lost is found, than in anything else. So that the idea here, as we move on from those three parables, which are really a theme with three movements, and to this chapter, remembering that the chapter divisions are not inspired. And understand the chapters and the verses and the punctuation weren't in the text. That was Middle Ages, those were all added. So sometimes we kind of make too hard a division when we're studying the scriptures, and that wasn't there. Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master's taken away my job." We all know what that might look like. "I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." Now he's going to do something that you would not really commend. And it's going to sound, in fact, this is underhanded. In fact, there's going to be some real litigation over this deal. But he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 800 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly," not the word quickly, while no one's looking, "and make it 400. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master, verse 8, commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. He didn't commend him because of his dishonesty, but he did commend the shrewdness, because he was leveraging the last component of his position for his own gain. And here's Jesus' point. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people or the children of light. Now, may I stop there before I hit the real application, which is the next verse. I think Jesus is saying is, in this parable, people who buy into a temporal world system are more consistent vis-a-vis their world's view, that this life is brief and ephemeral. May as well maximize your pleasure, minimize your pain, because we're only around once and that's going to be it. If you buy that philosophy, and many people do, they are more consistent with their philosophy than the children of light, who buy an eternal perspective, who live as if the temporal were more important than the eternal. You see the point there? He's saying they're more consistent with their worldview than people who claim to be children of light with their worldview. Because it's easy for a follower of Jesus to trust in Jesus for his eternal destiny in heaven, and then trust in the world for everything else. Their position, their possession, their security, significance. They look to the world for that, but they're not willing to trust him for the other. So that they swallow again the camel of the eternal and then strain at the gnat of the temporal. Why? Because eternity for them is very vague. But this now, this present darkness is very real. And so I'm saying that we are inconsistent. But may I go on to the application of this parable? I tell you, use worldly wealth The King James calls it filthy lucre. I always like that phrase. Use worldly wealth or mammon to gain friends for yourself so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. What does that mean? When is this worldly wealth going to be gone? It'll be gone when you die. You don't even need to wait till the second coming for that to happen. That'll become, because if the second coming doesn't precede you, you're going to be your first coming to him will be that. When you check out, worldly wealth will no longer have any value whatsoever. You'll leave it all behind. Remember the old phrase, you never see a U-Haul behind a hearse. Fact is, nobody ever brings it with them. So he goes on to say, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Let me give you my take on that. My understanding of this is if you want to live in a way that's shrewd, you will leverage the currency of this world and to transmute it into the currency of heaven. What you'll do is you'll take the time, talent, and treasure you've been entrusted with, you'll invest it in eternal beings, namely people, so that what will happen is the currency of this world, which is wealth, earthly wealth, will be transmuted into the currency of heaven, which is people. Because as you know, everything on this earth is going to be burned up. But the only two things on this planet that are going to endure that burning, that conflagration, are going to be people and the Word of God. So if you invest the truth of God into people and love and serve them, what will happen is you are now transmuting through that alchemy the temporal into the eternal. Because then it says, then there'll be people to welcome you into the eternal dwellings. There'll be people in heaven who will welcome you in because you invested the temporal resources you got into their eternal lives. Does that make sense to you? That's how I understand this text. And I think it's a radical challenge to us to realize we have been given only so much resource, but we can, in fact, if we choose to do it, leverage that by investing it into people, by serving and loving them with eternal values at heart. In our businesses, in our personal lives, wherever we are, we can leverage that so that we build into the currency of heaven, which is people. Because whenever you go to a new country, what do you always do when you go to the airport? You always change your currency. When you go to heaven, you're going to change your currency. And it's going to be a different currency. It's going to be people, because that's what all that life was about. You've got a very different orientation here. God says, actually, I'll multiply your lives. I want to turn you into a person who bears fruit. The only fruit that's going to really count is going to be eternal fruit. And remember, apart from him, you can bear how much fruit? Zero. So the only fruit that you're going to bear is what he does in you and through you. But he will use the resources you've been given so that that fruit can be born. That's the point. Stewardship, then, is a mindset of ownership, of accountability, of fidelity, and of wisdom, being shrewd in the resources. If you want to be a shrewd manager, a shrewd steward, you will wisely leverage it for the max. That's the kind, and not squander. And I fear that there's a danger I have with people that I've known where their temptation is to squander their best years and to take their best years. Here they built a lifetime of resources, of skills, of experiences, and then they fritter it away. When their last few years may be their best. My friend in Florida began to use his last years well. He fell away from fidelity to Christ for a number of years, and it was a sad thing to watch, but I must tell you, the last 3 years, the man was a different life, and he invested everything he had in building into the lives of people. And I want to tell you, God's the God of the second chance, and he will redeem the years the locust has eaten, and I believe that's exactly what happened in this guy's last life. I believe my friend, accomplished more in his last 3 years than he did probably the whole portion of his life. And my view is your best could be yet to come, and probably is, but you want to be shrewd from a spiritual standpoint. Finally, the last text is Genesis 39 to 41. I will not read those three chapters. Just to remind you, though, it's the story of Joseph. Remember, Joseph was a steward of Potiphar's house, and then finally became a steward of Pharaoh's Egypt, became the most powerful man other than Pharaoh in that empire. And the thing I want you to notice about this concept, again, was that Joseph, like others, invested in people, built into his family at the end of his life, and I want to suggest that a leader's commitment to develop the human resources that are placed in their charge are critical, and the greatest resource you'll ever be given is people. So that if I understand that's your major stewardship focus, please, I ask you, go back to what God deems to be important. And with that, I want to finish with, go back to my text in Luke 16 and draw one final application from the right after that parable of the unjust steward. After verse 9, he said, whoever can be entrusted, verse 10, with very little can also be entrusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. By the way, that's the fidelity of small things. If you are trustworthy in small things, you can be trustworthy in a lot. If you're dishonest in little things, it'll blow up into the large. If you haven't been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will entrust you with the true riches? None of us have experienced the true riches yet. We've only got a little dabbling of worldly wealth. And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, he'll give you property of your own. No servant can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And that is to say, neither can be your ultimate desire, your ultimate aspiration. Only one thing will be at the center of your heart and your heart's desire. And if it's the created order, you'll miss out. The Pharisees, remember he was talking to the Pharisees all along? Verse 14, the Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, you are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your heart. And here's the verse that stings me. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight. A wise steward would treat things according to their true value. Treasure the things God declares to be important, and hold with a loose grip the things that God says will not matter in the end.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.